You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 146. Today's episode is a deep dive into the West Bank, that area across the river that even most New Orleanians don't know too much about. The last show was all about Southern decadence, so if you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Today's episode is sponsored by our Patreon supporters. If you love the podcast, the Facebook group, and the work I'm doing, please consider becoming a monthly supporter. Find out more in the show notes for today's show or at patreon.com/beyondbourbonst. We have perks at all levels, and if you join at the $10 level or higher, we'll mention you in an upcoming episode. Support is also provided by the Historic New Orleans Collection. Currently, they're presenting the exhibition John Clemmer, A Legacy in Art. It's a comprehensive exploration of the life and work of a man who shaped the New Orleans art world for decades, often behind the scenes. Discover his work alongside pieces by more than 70 artists who called Clemmer an influencer, a teacher, or a friend. It goes on through November 7th, 2021 at 520 Royal Street, and as always, their admission is free. Plan your visit at hnoc.org/exhibitions. Now, on to today's topic. My guest has joined us before, a couple times actually. His lens of New Orleans through the viewpoint of geography always makes me see the city in a different light, and I know it will for you as well. Welcome to the show, Richard Campanella. How are you?
Thank you. Wonderful. Good to see you again.
It's been a while since you've been on.
Yes.
You've written a couple books since the last time I saw you. But today I wanted to talk about your book about the West Bank. So, you know, kind of first off, what drew your interest in the idea of a book about the West Bank?
Well, there was a proximate cause and an ultimate cause. As there typically are, and it's good to make that distinction. The proximate cause was a conversation I had with one Stuart Farnay in what proved to be the last year or two, so of his life. This was in 2017. He's a well-known local architect. He's also a direct descendant of the Destrehan, and Harvey families. And so he was a reader of mine, so we kind of knew each other, and he contacted me. This would have been 2017. To see if I was interested in possibly writing on his ancestors and their role in the development of the metropolis. And, you know, I told Stuart that, you know, I'm a geographer, I'm not really a biographer, but of course there's a blurry line between the two because people make place. And so we got to talking, and eventually I came to appreciate the role of his ancestors in the creation of the West Bank, namely the Harvey Canal, okay, that was originally the Destrehan Canal. That's probably not enough for a full book, and so as I delved into it, I quickly realized that this was an opportunity for me to connect with that ultimate driver, which has been brewing in me for decades, and that is to do a full-blown historical geography of the West Bank of Greater New Orleans. I had been studying the historical geography of all of New Orleans for 20 years prior. Here finally was an opportunity to delve specific, to put the West Bank front and center instead of treating it like this distant cousin of the real story on the East Bank. And so I got to work on it in 2017. The book came out 3 years later. But again, it rested on this pyramid of data and understanding I have the larger metropolis that was already 20 years old.
Sure. It's certainly a book that you couldn't have written right out of the gate.
Correct.
Right? It had to be built. And it feels that way, that it's built upon all your prior books and your prior delving into the city as a whole.
Right.
It's also interesting to me, we were just talking before we hit record, that I don't know of any other book that goes anywhere near. You know, the West Bank is glossed over. Sometimes you get something about Algiers Point. You might get an article about Algiers Point, right, in the historic neighborhood.
That's right. Well, let's look at the numbers there, okay? The West Bank is about 250,000 people. In the year 2000 census, that represented 1/4 of the metropolis. In the year 2010, it was 30% of the metropolis. And the percent actually went up. So if everything is equitable, one would expect that one out of every three articles, books, all the ballyhooing we do about this wonderful place would be about some story on the West Bank. At most, it's probably under 1%, and as you pointed out, is mostly about a small part of Algiers and maybe a little bit of Old Town Groton, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being a geographer who is interested in these very substantial parts of our urban geography that get so little attention because so much of the attention goes to the high historic districts, mm-hmm. I saw this as a wonderful opportunity to shift that focus and let them tell their story. And I would be kind of their spatial analyzer.
Well, and one of the first things that jumped out at me when I started to read it, again, it's called The West Bank of Greater New Orleans, A Historical Geography, is that this isn't a small book. So there was plenty of material there for you to dive into.
There was. It's in primary sources. Mm-hmm. It's in arcane literature that has barely been tapped. And so just bringing that to light and then footnoting everything.
Sure.
My hope is that this reaches a broader audience, particularly folks on the West Bank, and then they could delve into those sources and find even more for them.
And that's certainly what I found. And we'll get into the heart of the book in just a moment. But this is a book where the footnotes are really, really useful, because if you start reading, and we'll talk about, say, the Harvey Canal, if you start reading about something and you're really interested, then you can go dig
exactly
deep into that. So as large, again, when I first saw the book come out, in my mind, I was thinking this was going to be a relatively short book. Again, my own, you know, my own naivete about part of my hometown. And it's not. And then you can go dig, like I got very interested in the tunnel and the canal, and you can follow the footnotes down a rabbit hole pretty deeply.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get, you know, the first thing I think I know near and dear to your heart is the geography. And
yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about the formation,
absolutely,
the geography of the West Bank?
Well, let me talk about some of the distinguishing aspects of the geography, mm-hmm, of the West Bank. Because one, as I started delving into this, I was amazed at how much I did not know, chagrined by that, but also thrilled at how much I had to unlearn about the geography of Greater New Orleans when the focus is on the West Bank. That is to say, the circumstances that explain a lot of the spatiality, if you will, the emergence of our modern map in the human geography, the urban geography on the East Bank simply did not apply to the West Bank. And I'll give you some examples. The West Bank in the heart of the metropolis is on the cut bank side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
The river, just picture this trajectory, almost like a bobsled coming down a track. As it comes around the Carrollton Bend, it bears into the West Bank and it scours and erodes. The East Bank, uptown, warehouse district, is on the Point Bar side. The river velocity slows, it deposits sediment. The East Bank has gained land. The West Bank has lost land. So one of the great concerns throughout the long 19th century on the West Bank were these cave-ins and unbelievable crevasses,
mm-hmm,
the likes of which did not happen in the heart of the East Bank there. Here's another example. I spend a lot of time mapping what I call ethnic geography, residential, mm-hmm, settlement patterns by ethnicity, class, race. People, of course, do not evenly or randomly distribute themselves across the cityscape. So where and how and why there, why they end up where they are, is a topic of great interest to geographers.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic patterns historically on the East Bank is this front of town, back of town pattern.
Yeah.
Where wealth and power and privilege gravitated to the higher front of town, closer to the river, although not right at the river because it was, mm-hmm, a working river, and poverty and destitution and disempowerment were literally and figuratively marginalized to the back swamp in the,
sure,
rear of the city. That didn't happen on the West Bank. And the reason is it was so rural and population densities were so low that there was plenty of space for everyone, even disempowered populations, mm, on the high ground closer to the river. And for this reason, one of the largest, substantially sized, predominantly people of African ancestry neighborhoods to form that still exists in its same place today was a part of Algiers called Freetown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's roughly under the bridges today. And to this day, it is a historic high ground that is overwhelmingly African American. And so when you look at the racial geographies of the two banks, you see more of a checkerboard pattern, regardless of topography on the West Bank, and a very kind of layered front of town, back of town pattern on the East mm-hmm. Bank.
And I also, like, as I read your book, I tried to think of it in terms of coastal erosion and the wetlands, but you effectively had this part of the continent and this part of the United States, this part of New Orleans, which had this sort of bountiful side on both sides of it, right? That is very different than any other part of New Orleans, really, because you had gone out to the ocean, the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And then you had the river plantations and then the commerce just across the river here in you know, the other part of New Orleans.
Right. Similarities trump differences when you compare the basic underlying geography of the two. Both of them, they're both on the deltaic plain. Mm-hmm. They're both created by Mississippi River sediment deposition. There's a natural levee and a back swamp on both sides. There are ridge systems when there used to be distributaries. But here's a distinction. If you look at how the Mississippi makes that sharp bend around English Turn and then comes in Plaquemines around mm-hmm. Jesuit Bend, and then you zoom out and look over towards Westwego and Avondale, that loop, that grand loop, forms something of almost like an amphitheater. Mm-hmm. And that was very inviting to early 20th century drainage. I call them the drainage kings, these private sector savvy landholders who figured out drainage. And when you have a loop, an amphitheater like that, it becomes very clear where you put your back levee and where you put your pumps. And so that allowed the West Bank to do what took the East Bank almost 200 years to drain its back swamp was done in the West Bank in an incredibly short amount of time. A couple of years, 1913, 14, 15, and then there was this big ceremony just before Mardi Gras. It was called Hero Day. The gentleman's name was George Hero, and he was the drainage king. a king named Hero and a hero who was the king.
Right.
And there was this lavish parade on Saturday just before Mardi Gras down St. Charles Avenue. They took a yacht across the river. They all went all the way up the Harvey Canal to the back swamp and had this ceremony there to activate these gigantic, recently installed Baldwin wood pumps mm-hmm. at that spot. And they had Woodrow Wilson in the White House press a button to activate the pumps. In 3 hours, the West Bank back swamp was drained.
And that's a theme in your book. And I want to jump back and then jump back forward. That's a theme in your book about this idea of mastering the drainage there and developing entire towns or neighborhoods, certainly.
Yep.
If we could jump back just a bit, though, and there's so much in the book, there's no way we'll get to all of it. I'm going to say this several times. This is a book well worth taking and diving into. But going all the way back to, say, Paugher and Bienville, if you could talk about that a little bit, and the land concessions were important on the West Bank from the very beginning.
That's right. The West Bank had that interesting mix of accessibility and inaccessibility. Mm-hmm. It was right across the river, but you had to cross a river. And concessions, this process of granting land, was a way for the Company of the West, and then later the Crown itself, to engage the colonial administrators in the success of the Louisiana Project. Mm-hmm. How do you make them stakeholders? You give them land. And so Bienville's concessions, I should say, we're sitting not on the West Bank right now. We're on the East Bank in Uptown. We are sitting on Bienville's concession right here.
Oh, really?
He granted himself everything from his plantation house, which was just above Common Street, mm-hmm. all the way up to what is now Carrollton, plus areas on the West Bank. And he actually had a summer home on the West Bank. And so Algiers itself, what is now Algiers Point, became this very important company plantation warehouse, and it was also the main depot, for lack of a better word, and jail and prison for the very first enslaved people of African ancestry mm-hmm. who were kidnapped out of the Senegambia region in late 18, came up the river, and in early 1719 were brought to what is now the Algiers Point riverfront.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And again, that whole theme carries through the book as well, where you talk about that. It was a warehousing, as horrible as that is, right? It was a warehousing of people as well as other commodities, because that's the way it was seen.
It was the workshop of the colony.
Sure, sure. So it was valuable for all sorts of reasons there. One of the things that struck me in your book is that you talked about, again, that it was a supplier and a holding point on the East Bank. And you talked about German immigrants quite a bit there.
Yeah, two very separate waves. The first wave came in thanks to John Law and his Company of the West, mm-hmm. where he's selling Prince Felipe on this idea that wealth need not be backed up by real wealth, i.e. gold, which France didn't have, but it could be backed up on the promise of commercial wealth. And so stock was sold mm-hmm. in Louisiana, the Louisiana being that promise. In order for to make this happen, you have to people the place. And so the peopling came from various forms of encouraged or forced immigration on the part of white Europeans, including Germans and Swiss, and then, of course, slavery on the part of Senegambians. So that first wave of German-speaking peoples suffered terribly in their trip here. There were some of them ended up in different places. They settled on predominantly what we now call the German coast, which is predominantly a West Bank community. The next wave came under very different circumstances over a century later, and they were the German immigrants of the 1830s and 40s, including the so-called 48ers. They're better educated, they're more likely to be skilled, but they also have this problem of not speaking either local language. Mm-hmm. And so many of them gravitated to the old Lafayette area where Chapultepec meets Jackson, what do we now call the Irish Channel, because mm-hmm. just as many Irish immigrants also landed there. Ferries explain, very importantly, explain how East Bank communities ended up on the West Bank. That was pretty much the only way to cross the river. So wherever a private company installed a ferry, that became a cedar of the area right across the river for people to move. And there was one from the old St. Mary Market across the river, and there was another one operated up until only about a dozen years ago, the Gretna Ferry, mm-hmm. which went from Jackson Avenue straight to Gretna. That allowed Germans on the East Bank to populate what became known as Mechanics Ham, and that is today's Gretna.
And you talk about in the book that the placement of ferries at first and then later bridges has a huge, had and still has a really huge impact on population distributions. And that at one point, it was much easier to get across the river than it was to get from one point on the West Bank to another point on the West Bank.
That's right. And you know, I don't know if we want to stay in chronological order, sure. but you know, the Huey P. Long Bridge is the first regional connector of the two, 1935. But that's designed primarily for railroads. The motorists mm-hmm. were an afterthought, and I'm sure you remember just how much
how
of
narrow
a
the bridge
narrow
was.
Afterthought that was.
Right.
But it's way upriver. And so even when that bridge is put in, it was much more convenient for people in the Irish Channel and what we now call Bywater just hop on a ferry and get to their industry jobs on the West Bank.
Well, and again, as you point out, that was much, much later too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, this relatively modern, and then it wasn't even widened until fairly recently to make it accessible for cars. Right?
Here, we have the largest city in the South up until the 1940s that did not have a bridge over its major river for the first 220 years of its existence. And I think that in large part explains why there is a cultural chasm between the East and the West Bank.
Hmm. That's interesting.
A sneering factor, if you will.
And has always been that way, seemingly always, right?
Yeah. It had different characteristics. It was more of an urban rural mm-hmm. looking askance, mm-hmm. and it later became kind of a class and a cultural askance look down. And I theorized this toward the end of the book.
And
it's not unique to here.
And yet there was plenty of wealth there, and you talk about plantations, and maybe as an entree into that, you discussed it in one of our earlier episodes, but I'll forgive the listeners since there's 140 something of them. Maybe explain briefly an arpent and how that comes into play.
Yeah, an arpent was the French equivalent of an acre. It was 192 feet. The main difference between it was used to measure a surficial area like an acre, but it was also used as a linear measure. And so the French cadastral system, that is the land surveying system in Louisiana, is extremely important. You cannot understand the geography of this place unless you understand that. And long story short, the land was divvied up, the natural levy, in these elongated so-called French long lots that were typically 6 to 8 to 12 arpents wide, a few blocks, and 40 to 80 arpents deep. If you multiply out each of those numbers by 192, it's about a mile and a half to 3 miles, and that's typically the width of the natural levee. So just like on the East Bank, Imagine these isosceles triangles laid out perpendicularly to the river, except that because the West Bank is on the convex side of a curve, they diverge. In other words, a plantation at the river is fairly narrow, and as you get all the way back to Barataria Basin, it widens. On the East Bank, where we are sitting right now, they narrow, okay? So if you think of the various old plantations that used to be along Chapultepec Street, they might be a few hundred or 500,000 feet wide. By the time you get back to Broad and Fontainebleau, you could throw a baseball and get to the other side. So these were, at first, they were quite a bit used for timber extraction as well as pasture. These became rice and indigo plantations after 1795. They became predominantly sugar plantations. But here's another angle where the West Bank delivers. It had this, and I could expound on this, I call it, for lack of a better word, the close but not too close phenomenon. And I don't think in all of geography there's a term for this. And by this, I mean the West Bank was close enough to serve the economic needs of the big, dense metropolis across the way, but not close enough that the high land values would affect it. And that's why truck farms were there. It was really good for raising edibles instead of just export commodities. You could raise them and then in 40 minutes get to across the French market. Same thing with industry. You could have a big footprint polluting industry and tap into the workforce thanks to the ferries and the local communities on the West Bank and sell to the metropolis across the river while avoiding the high land values of the metropolis across the river. That's what I mean. It was close enough to benefit, but not so close that all those high costs would be detrimental.
Sure. Well, and this is another episode altogether, but you see that even today with what we call Cancer Alley and all of the industry on that side of the river as you go, you know, as you go away from New Orleans, low land costs, easy to acquire, big industry.
Fresh water,
access to the railroads, access to the shipping lanes, all of that stuff. I hadn't thought of it in that way. Another interesting, and I am kind of jumping around here because I think it's the point about the plantations and the shape really struck me that they're different. And it kind of got back to your earlier point about the river and how it kind of sluices through the turns here in New Orleans. You can see that, especially I've seen you take pictures when the river level is really low. And that really brought home for me, you see the difference between when the river is low on the East Bank versus the West Bank. You can kind of actually see what you're talking about how one loses land, one gains land, right? And how that's very different. And so I think that's interesting when you combine it with the shape of the plantations and the fact that they're not quite mirrors, but like the inverse of each other, right?
Right.
One of the things that I did want to ask you about is you mentioned in your book this idea that I hadn't heard of before, and that is the West Bank Congo Square. If you could expound on that just a little bit.
Yeah. Again, keep in mind that notion of inaccessible accessibility, this paradox, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it was close, but not too close. And so a lot of the activities that were viewed through a certain lens on the East Bank as being problematic or something to be concerned about if you're in the white power class, ended up on the West Bank. And some of that were Sunday rendezvous for enslaved people. And you see this really early in the colonial era that there were these Congo Square-like get-togethers on Sunday off days, and they crossed the river and rendezvoused on the West Bank. Also, this phenomena of maroonage, which was the regional equivalent of, for enslaved people in the Upper South, they were close enough to the north across the Ohio, et cetera, Mason-Dixon line, where there was hope of escaping to freedom in the north. Down here was so far away that that was a very distant possibility. And so escaping slavery to freedom meant going out to the back swamp and the marshes and these inaccessible areas. And the West Bank was that much less accessible. You had the wilds of the Barataria region, whereas if you went over to the lakefront in New Orleans East, you still had what is now West End, Spanish Fort, Milburn. I mean, there were railroads, there were canals.
Sure.
There was more access there. So the fact that the Barataria formed this kind of soft, porous edge of the continent also made it, in fact, I have a chapter on this, an entrepot for contraband.
Right.
Where during that whole messy interregnum era, when each You know, the Spanish, the French, the Americans all had these tax policies and import. If you wanted to circumvent all that, you came through the West Bank. You came through the Barataria.
Well, and in fact, so you have a chapter on that, and I have in my notes, I have smuggling and geography,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's a good time to talk about the history of the use of the word Barataria.
Yeah. Yeah, it comes, it makes a mention in Don Quixote, but that's not the origin of the term. The term comes from barratry, which is an old English term that spilled over into the adjacent, you know, French and Spanish language. And basically what it meant was crime on water, crime on the high seas, various forms of smuggling and piracy. And that's how extensive it was. And when we think of the Lafitte brothers, they're the most prominent, and they were the ringleaders of this whole assemblage of complicit individuals who stewarded this flow of, and you know, of materials, but
right.
It also very much included enslaved people.
Sure.
Coming out of particularly the Spanish colonial world, it was illegal in the 1810s to import enslaved peoples from international destinations. This is after that 1808 law, but it was not illegal to export them out of places like Galveston, which was under Spanish colonial, or Cuba. And so the most convenient way to come in was through Grande Terre and through the Lafitte brothers and the Baratarians.
Yeah. And
crime on water.
That part of the book really drew me in because, of course, most everyone familiar with New Orleans knows the Lafitte brothers and maybe has heard of the idea of piracy. But really, again, when you layer it with place and geography, it starts to make sense. And your earlier comments about maroonage and sort of being a place of escape also makes it a perfect place for illegal and illicit activity, right?
That's right. That's right. You could get away with things.
Right.
It was at the fringes of political and economic control, and interesting things tend to happen in those places.
Even today, right?
Yep.
And so maybe that's a good segue. I want to talk about industry, and you talk in your book a lot about the changes in the period you just mentioned. So you come after the War of 1812, and you really start to see industries grow and change and develop there.
Yep. A major early one that we still have today, and you only need to look straight across from Jackson Square to see it, is dry docks and shipbuilding.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of reasons here. On the geophysical side, remember that bobsled coming down the river, right? So the river leans into the West Bank and it scours there, but that also means the Thalweg is over there. And the Thalweg is the deepest trench of the river, okay? And if you look at the bathymetry of the river, it's not a perfect V.
Right.
It's a V that leans over to the side depending on how the river meanders. And so the deepest water is, historically and today, it's closer and closest to the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
That was bad for erosion and crevasses, but it also meant you had a nice deep harbor there. Economically, all the entrepot action, the transshipment, the load, unload, ships coming in, move, flatboats, get out of there, steamboats come in, ocean-going ships, that was in the East Bank. That was in front of the French Quarter. That was right off Chapultepec Street, what we now call the Warehouse District. That was in Marigny. You didn't have the place, space, or time for careful, deliberative ship repair and for shipbuilding. The West Bank was perfect for that. Okay? Again, close but not too close. You had the space. You had the deep harbor. And so starting around, I think around 1810, the very first slip was built there. And to this day, there's a dry dock, the Mollinger dry dock, which is essentially, it's a boat for a broken boat. It opens up. It takes on water. You float in the broken boat. You close it off. You pump out the water. Crews come in. They fix the hull, and they're off to go. That's a perfect activity for the West Bank. Avondale, the largest employer in the state, a private employer, had over 12,000 employees only a generation or so ago.
Right.
It's on the West Bank. And so you have all sorts of other value-added industries. And I make this point that, you know, a lot of times we self-criticize this metropolis for being weak in manufacturing, being weak in industry, of having missed that chance, of relying so much on the river, missing that chance to develop the industries at St. Louis and, you know, Ohio and places like that. The West Bank did have those industries. The West Bank did seize those opportunities. And the very fact that we say that the metropolis did not necessarily means we are excluding that story.
Right.
And it's because there's been so little written on it that it didn't percolate into the secondary literature and the newspaper articles.
Well, and as you're describing that, I think about, so we're recording this at the end of Broadway, right up against the Mississippi River on the East Bank. Very close to here is a very popular spot called The Fly behind Audubon Park, behind Audubon Zoo. And from there, you can see the shipbuilding apparatus, right?
You can see the barges, and you could look clear across. You know, if we were here just a few maybe a couple of generations ago, you could see from the East Bank by Audubon Park, if you look straight west across, you would see the roof of the Seven Oaks Plantation House, which was the Zering Plantation, plays a major role in Westwego history. Majestic building, of course, with all the associations with slavery, it was demolished only in 1977, the ruins of which. And I spoke to a person who knew the very last people who rented rooms in there in the 1950s. And one of them said, you could hear the lions roar in Audubon Zoo.
Really?
That's how close it is. It's a couple thousand feet away. And of course, the roar is kind of a bassy roar. It carries across the river. You could be sitting on the gallery of this 1840 plantation house and hear
that's
the
amazing.
Lion. And it really struck me of just how close yet far
These
two sub-societies are, these two sub-regions.
And I feel that way when you sit out at the Fly. Fly is a popular place to go watch a sunset. You see the river traffic, you know, but you can see across. And so here we are. If you, again, geography, if you're there behind Audubon Park, you're in this very affluent part of New Orleans, and you look across, and it still looks really rural from what you can see right there, right?
Yeah.
It really does. And it's not physically far, geographically far, but again, that cut, the river, what you see makes a difference. You alluded to this, and so I kind of want to transition to talk about, people know Algiers Point. I think if people know anything of the West Bank, they know Algiers Point and the historic nature and the wonderfulness that is that neighborhood. But let's talk a little bit about some of the other areas of the West Bank that you explore in the book.
Happily. My favorite spot?
Okay.
Westwego.
Hmm.
Sallaville, the historic district in Westwego. Amazing little place on many levels. It is urban, it is suburban, but it also has this fascinating, I love the notion of a jumping off point. I'm very intrigued by that notion. A jumping off point being, either historically today, a space from which access is particularly convenient to distant places. And Westwego in particular was the jumping off point into the Atacapas region of South Central Louisiana, and what today we understand to be the Acadian Triangle. It was also the jumping off point to the Western frontier, thanks to railroads. But focusing on the Acadian angle here, you'll often hear local people who are very savvy about local history sort of chiding tourists about, no, New Orleans is not a Cajun town, and there's Creole and there's Cajun, and there's two different foods and two different areas. The Cajuns are over to the west, and that's an important point to make, but it's also important not to overmake that point because of Westwego and Marrero. If you look on a map, these are in the southwestern quadrant of the metropolis, and they are adjacent and even abutting the edge of the Acadian Triangle. And the Company Canal, which was excavated to connect what is now Westwego through Bayou Saguenay over to Bayou Lafourche and points over to Morgan City, dug in the 1830s, becomes this very important artery connecting Acadian people, indigenous, Homa, Creole peoples of that lower Lafourche region. They came up the Company Canal, they brought their seafood, they sold it in Sallaville, and Sallaville became Cannery Row. Again, manufacturing. I could show you photos of hundreds of women in particular, black and white, who were employed, well employed, decently employed, in Sallaville and Old Westwego, cleaning out the crabs, canning, and they distributed throughout the whole region. 1893 is a terrible hurricane that absolutely devastates the Grand Isle area, so much so that the fishing and oystering fleet is destroyed there. So where did those Cajuns and Homa indigenous go? They came up the Company Canal where they had long done business, and they settled in Westwego and Sallaville. And if you look at the census and the ancestry data, there are substantially sized Cajun communities, people of Cajun ancestry with Cajun names in those areas. So when we say, oh, it's not a Cajun town, again, the West Bank has already had this aside. And I could show you evidence from as recently as the 1940s and 50s where Cajun French was the street language in downtown Oswego.
Well, three things struck me in reading that part of your book. One, this idea of Cannery Row.
Yeah.
You know, again, my own bias, I thought of the West Bank and the industry as the shipbuilding, but hadn't thought, and it makes sense, there are still today plenty of farms and seafood harvesting there, right? But this idea of Cannery Row or along the canal, and then as obvious as this seems, we pronounce it West We Go, but when you break it apart, West We Go, right, starts to tie into, well, of course it ties into Acadiana and like a gateway there, right? Not only with the railroads, but geographically, as you pointed out. And it was sort of an aha moment for me. Local brewery Faubourg recently released a beer called West We Go. But we don't say it that way here, right? We say West We Go, and you don't really stop to think about it. It was a name with a real meaning of connecting to the West.
Oh, it very much was. It was explicitly coined by railroad men, 1869, 1870. And I describe this in the book as a rare moment of pithy jocularity among men not normally associated with either. I mean, 19th century railroad men are pretty serious stock. And they coined it to advertise that this was the connection to the Western frontier. What also happens in 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad is finished at Promontory Point, Utah, and Americans are leapfrogging west. This is going to be the Southern Transcontinental. And sure enough, within a very short amount of time, if you wanted to get to the Pacific, you had to go through Algiers and you had to go to Oswego.
Yeah, it was really like an aha moment for me to stop and think about that, right? And again, maybe because of your earlier point about the lack of literature, even growing up here as a New Orleanian, you just weren't taught that.
Yeah.
You didn't know it.
Exactly. Yeah. And conversely, I got railroads heading west. That means railroads are also coming here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Western produce starts to come here, particularly cattle. There were cattle drives, Western-style cattle drives, longhorns coming through, going through slaughterhouses, through dusty streets in Harvey and Marrero. Not that long ago, circa 1900.
So that was the other part. I tend to think of the traffic coming through the Midwest and coming down, and you and I have talked about this, coming down the rivers, right? But I hadn't thought as much about the trains. And again, you talk about that in this expansion, this moment in time, and where the West Bank and Oswego in particular play such an important role.
Yep.
The other thing, and we could go on and on, but another thing I really wanted to talk to you about is the canals. You mentioned the Company Canal and the Harvey Canal and how vital they were to the growth and to this idea of mastery of water on the West Bank, mastery of drainage.
Almost
right?
Too much mastery.
Right? And we see that today.
The canals were railroads before the railroads, right? Mm-hmm. And they went where railroads couldn't go by the very watery nature of the access that they provide. And so the very first ones dug are the earliest colonial times by enslaved population, 1720s, 30s, and they were timber extraction canals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them live on hydrologically, if not the actual trajectory, in the form of drainage canals today. And they were put in to wait till low water, you know, kind of a October, November dry season. The back swamp would lower. You could send cutters in there, cut down cypress and big logs, and then, you know, float them in on these narrow dug canals and get them over and mill them. And you mill them on the West Bank and then over to, and they also went into the shipbuilding industry. And then come the canals for navigation purposes. And the first biggest of these is the Destrehan, which the Destrehan family, Detrehan, marries into the Harvey family, and that professionalizes to become today's Harvey Canal. Their big competitor was that Company Canal, and there is this fierce rivalry between Harvey and Oswego and between the Harvey family and the Barrow family that owned the Company Canal. And you already know who won this, right? Because everyone knows the Harvey Canal, but very few people won the remember the Company Canal. And by won, I mean the federal government purchased rights to connect the Intracoastal Waterway with the Harvey Canal. This is in the 1920s, and the rest is history. And that's why you go on the West Bank Express, you go all the way up, and you look down on this huge Harvey Canal, which, by the way, is still owned by descendants of the Destrehan and Harvey family, including Stuart Farnay, the gentleman I mentioned at the beginning, whereas the company canal was largely filled in the early 1960s, but still exists in Bayou Saguenay. You know the shrimp lot where you buy all your shrimp there?
Of course.
That is there because that is where the company canal came through the West Bank. That is why you buy those shrimp there.
Yeah, and you mentioned, right, the shrimp. It's still, the West Bank is still the place where New Orleanians know to go buy seafood, right?
In that particular spot.
That spot, right.
For that reason.
That's interesting.
Going back to 1830. In fact, if you looked at the filled-in portion of the canal, the one that was dug by slave labor 190 years ago, it's filled in now, but you could still see a very slight indentation, and you could see where the water puddles after a rain. And so there's a visual vestige of this very important trajectory that brought in those Creole populations, that brought in those Cajun populations. This is what I mean by historical geography.
Well, and this is what continued to suck me in the book. I had my own sort of bias and ignorance about the West Bank, but this whole discussion between the two families and the canals could have been a book in and of itself. It almost reads like a novel in terms of this back and forth. And I thought about the Hatfields and the McCoys a little bit, right? Because so much was at stake when you think about commerce, right? And it all centered around that water, which again gets back to such a central theme in New Orleans in general. So that alone to me, you know, there were these aha moments. That was one of them about these. And you talk about company towns that were built up. You know, this was big industry, big business. And in some ways, once you've read it, you can see that footprint still today, which is really fascinating to me.
Well, the urbanism is interesting and distinct on the West Bank because, remember, there's no bridges. It's all about these ferries. And I use the term, a term that is not in much circulation in American English that I think ought to be, and it is sub-rural. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows what suburban is. But if you think of the spectrum from completely like wilderness at one end and, you know, Times Square at the other, there's different densities of urbanism. And then there's inner suburbs and edge cities and exurbs. And then you have this zone between the suburban and the edge cities and exurbs, but is not completely rural. There's smaller towns. And so this word sub-rural, I think, and that's what the West Bank was. It was sort of, I use the term, this necklace of villages, this necklace of little tiny urban enclaves that have these truck farms and sort of this petering out that it's more rural and more agricultural and slightly more urban, but never really intensely concretized. You don't have any garden district equivalents, but nor do you have the impoverished back of town equivalents. You don't have the sort of slave quarters that you see appended to big fancy townhouses in the heart of the French Quarter, because there was enough of a low density and enough of a rural environment around each of these villages such that enslaved peoples were not held immediately adjacent to the house of the master. They could be off in more of a human geography that you see on the plantations. And so they were called villages, and only well into the 20th century did they start to incorporate into towns and cities.
Interesting. And, you know, we could go on and on because the book is full of so many of those stories. And I would really encourage people, there's so many things. You talk about the Mr. Go Canal, you talk about Tarrytown. There's so many little vignettes that in and of themselves are interesting. Yeah. And then again, you have the book heavily footnoted so that someone can really dive in if they're interested in that and go even deeper to it. Put you on the spot just a little bit. You mentioned Westwego as maybe your favorite part. Was there another nugget maybe that you came across that was an aha moment for you as a geographer when you thought about the West Bank?
I was blown away by the magnitude of the crevasse floods there, their commonality, their sheer unbelievable spatial extent, and how little they're remembered, even among historically aware people here. People who know New Orleans history probably know the Sauve crevasse flood of 1849, the Bonnie Carey crevasse flood of 1871. These were East Bank floods that worked their way through the back swamp and flooded New Orleans proper from the rear. But then there's like the Bell Crevasse of 1858 and a number like that, roughly every few years, where a levee would rupture. And basically, because again, you're on that cut bank side, the water roared through and scoured crevasses that were hundreds of feet wide and, get this, dozens of feet deep.
Wow.
Dozens of feet on a natural levee that only has a dozen feet.
Right.
Okay. And so they're very hard to plug. They're very risky to plug. And imagine that whole greater West Bank all the way down to Grand Isle, okay, that amphitheater, going from Bayou Lafourche over to Plaquemines Parish and from the metro area all the way down to the open Gulf of Mexico. Imagine 99% of that underwater, everything except the very highest natural levee closest to the Mississippi River. That's what we're talking about.
Wow.
Okay? All that said, as devastating as that was, the water was not impounded. It was not trapped because there wasn't a drainage system to trap it.
Right.
It flowed. And so it was knee-deep to waist-deep water as opposed to catastrophic water, which I think is a very interesting commentary that as bad as things were, we didn't completely replumb the delta such that they became catastrophic. And that's why we don't really have a memory. You know, if water is flooding depopulated areas, we tend not to call it a disaster. You know, if a lightning strikes in the middle of the Rockies and a bunch of elk die, we're not going to record it as a terrible disaster.
Sure, right. But when a levee breaks and floods in an area like Katrina and it's contained, then it's
impounded. People are living there. We put humans in, exposed them to risk and hazard, and they were vulnerable, and so you have catastrophic losses.
Interesting. Again, the book is, to me, it's an entertaining read. It's fascinating. It's again, and I say all of this as a New Orleans, a native New Orleanian, it's fascinating to uncover and sort of, all through the lens, as you do with all your other books, you're a geographer, and so having that spatial sort of leap through history. I learned so much. I was entertained, but I learned a lot. The point you bring up along the canals and where we go today to get shrimp, right? And that once you know some of the things that you describe in the book and that you talked about today on the show, you never see that the same way.
Exactly.
I went to go get shrimp just a couple weeks after I had read the book, and I just found myself looking around, right? Like looking for the landmarks and really this appreciation of place. Which is what I think you do so well in this book, is this appreciation of place.
Thank you.
So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
I appreciate you joining me today. But before we go, you have a newer book, a collaboration project. Would you mind just kind of sharing with readers what that project is?
It's called Above New Orleans, Roofscapes of the Crescent City. And so far as we can tell, and I'm always worried about absolutes and superlatives, it appears to be the very first full-length book of drone photography of an American city. There are other books about drone photography, but they're all over the place.
Right.
And so this is a collaboration I did with a friend and colleague of mine by the name of Marco Rassi, who's a retired civil engineer, lives locally. We got to know each other. I was a big admirer of his photography, and he was a fan of my work. He sat in on a number of my classes, etc. And we both realized in mid-2020 that we could do things together that we couldn't. I couldn't do the drone photography, and he could do the geography. So we worked really hard on it and wanted to be the first, you know, to do these spectacular drone photos. And I love this notion of roofscapes. It's not my coinage, but it's another one of those words that I'd like to get into circulation more, which I define as being this perspective that is high enough, this aerial perspective, that in a city that is high enough to be synoptical, but low enough to be intimate. So you could still see people and interactivity. And so what's great about drones is that you're able to gain perspectives that were utterly unattainable.
Yeah.
Before, you couldn't get a helicopter 200 feet over Congo Square, right?
Sure, right, right.
There's no roof there. So that was fun. The other larger project I'm working on, which I'm coming to the conclusion of, is the first ever full-blown history of drainage in the city. Drainage.
And you get into that little bit in the
book.
That's
where it came from.
Right.
That's where the idea came from the Drainage King.
And it's interesting you say that, because as I was reading about the West Bank and the drainage, you think so much of our geography and so much of our history in this part of Louisiana is influenced by the decisions that were made, right, on that.
Yep,
so
exactly.
I can't wait to see that. I'll put links to your website and how people can purchase your books, as well as Marco online. He's a great follow on Instagram and on Twitter. And often you post pictures of, say, from from a cupola or from somewhere in the French Quarter, and he takes these pictures from a couple hundred feet up.
Yeah, so straight down, amazing shots. Yeah. You will see aspects and angles of New Orleans that you have never seen before. It's just flabbergasting.
And he's a great photographer, right? Yeah. So that idea of one, you have to get up, but then two, you have to have the skill to do something with it.
Yeah, he also has a sense of wittiness and whimsy in his photos. That's absolutely delightful.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Yeah. Once again, thank you so much for joining me. We'll put links to getting the book in the show notes, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Sophia and Olivia to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.